Welcome. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's freaking gorgeous down here. It's in the middle of a drought in a tropical island. A tropical island drought. How about them apples? Apparently it hasn't been this dry since 1950s. It's almost as dry as English wit. My very special guest is Ivan Owen. Ivan, welcome to the program.
Yes, can you hear me all right?
I can hear you all right. Now, you've tried to turn your webcam on, but it's not working. So if you just press the little webcam button again, that should turn it off, and that'll give us a higher quality audio stream. And also, just in case, if you have a phone number or something like that, just in case your connection's not that great, just pop it into the Skype chat here, and we'll bring you on that, if needs be. Right, well, anyway, Ivan, are you the musician that I listened to that had like amazing songs and stuff like that? I think my mate Daryl introduced me to you.
Yeah, first up, big up to Daryl, Daryl Projectile Jones. He's my friend on Facebook. I guess I don't know if you know him personally.
I do. I've known Daryl a long time. Done plenty of gigs together. I'm the cameraman, he's the MC.
Nice. Basically I make hip-hop and reggae, here, London-based. I also do battle rap. And, yeah, basically our mutual friends said it would be a good idea for us to link up on the show. And yeah, I've been checking out some of your episodes recently and definitely feeling the show and the vibe and just feel fully blessed to be here.
Well, the show is pretty episodic.
Yeah. I've noticed you got very many. You're very prolific. Extremely prolific.
Yeah. Like AIDS. But, maybe that was below the belt.
I don't know, is AIDS prolific?
I don't know. Is it political?
Is it political?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe I just confused the two. Like, I see politicians as a disease, AIDS is a disease, and I thought, well, AIDS is political. No, sorry.
Okay, yeah, could be.
There's a weird process going on up here. It's sleep deprivation. All right. I was up at 3 a.m., dude.
Yeah.
Give a homie a break.
No worries. What time is it then?
It's 11:05 a.m.
Okay, yeah. So, yes, it's just coming into 10 o'clock, just past 10 here in London. So, the end of a long day, but yeah.
How did you actually get into your music, man?
I say basically, probably going on for about 10 years ago, first started really being into UK hip hop. There's artists here like Task Force, Roots Maneuver, who kind of showed me that hip-hop could be done in a different way to the hip-hop that's presented in mainstream culture, in mainstream outlets. And that also hip-hop could be authentic to the area you're from. So you didn't have to mimic American style hip-hop personas, but you could still embody the hip-hop culture but be true to your environment and the location and who you are, basically. And so, basically, it was initially local artists from my area who came before me and inspired me to start writing, just get out a pad and pen and start writing my first rhymes, which were, you know, pretty average. And through persistence and a love of it, just started to increase my abilities and found it to be a great creative outlet for me. And I've been writing ever since. I also produce music in my studio, just running Logic, and I play a few bits of different instruments. So I make a lot of beats as well. And from there, yeah, I've released an album last year. Actually, it's 2011 now. I released my first album called The Last Picnic. And also, since then, last year, got into battle rap, which has been a very interesting experience. And just trying to push on. I'm working on my next album for this year. So at the minute, I'm just doing the beats. I'm in the studio, being creative, making all these different soundtracks. And then I'm going to do the writing. Will come after that. So that's where I'm at the minute.
Yeah. And you're quite political in the things that you talk about. Are you a truther? You know, 9/11 is an inside job, trilateral commission of full of scumbags, the bankers are to blame for the global economy, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm in that general ballpark. You know, you're in the right area. I say probably, like for a lot of people, 9/11 was the gateway drug to further truth. Back a few years ago, I think my initial gateway kind of information was actually a book by Alan Watts called The Way of Zen, which I read when I must be maybe 19, 20, and which was the first initial kind of process where I kind of de-schooled my thinking, and this book really opened my mind to a totally different way of looking at life and reality. And I think that was a real start for me, a real start of my self-education, having left school, self-education and pursuit of knowledge and understanding. And yeah, following on from that, someone gave me a video on 9/11, which makes you 100% question then everything you're told by government and their narratives. And from then on, yeah, it's just been a journey leading through, I guess, 9/11 to, you know, yeah, the financial apparatus, to then things you can do personally in your life. So I got into permaculture, did a permaculture design course, and got into, you know, gardening, these type of things, you know, get a bit more of that survivalist mentality. Bought myself a Berkey water filter. That kind of thing, trying to buy in bulk, just feeling more secure and trying to be more self-sufficient, able to stand on my own two feet without having to be spoon-fed by this system, so that I'll be, you know, 3 days away from a destitute situation.
Mm-hmm. And have you still got a form of slave employment, or are you self-employed, or is your music paying off for you? What's the situation there?
Yeah, basically, I work about 25 hours a week at the minute, every day between 12 and, well, Monday to Friday, 12 to 5. I actually work in a school, and I teach sports and chess. And so essentially, I guess I'm a government agent on one level. But
I suspected.
but on another level, like my role, I've been able to create my role so that I dictate what I teach, what my curriculum is. I only teach what I'm highly motivated to teach. Most of my lessons are open, free, the children can attend or not attend, except for ones which are curriculum, obviously. But, you know, extra clubs, they're kind of open and free. If you want to come, you come. If you don't, you don't. And yeah, within the system, which obviously has, you know, on educational level, serious flaws, an element of counterproductive outcomes, I'm trying to be progressive in what I do and offer those in the system an alternative of kind of a wide alternative of ideas and opportunities. With what I offer. But yeah, it's hard sometimes to marry those, you know, the two ideas, you know. But I feel okay about it. This guy Charles Taylor Gatto?
I've heard of it. Is it a kind of dessert?
Yeah, I know you like your puns. I've been listening to some of your shows. You've got some nice puns going on. You could actually be a battle rapper. Half of battle rap is wordplay and having some good puns you can pull out.
Yeah.
Basically, what is it? I think it's John Taylor Gatto or Charles Taylor Gatto. He's written a couple of books. He's from America. Was a high school teacher there for like 50 years, something like that. Won teacher of the year awards, but was essentially very disillusioned with the whole system. But he wrote a couple of books, one called Dumbing Down of America, and the other, The History of Public Education, something like really interesting books about going from the beginning, where he says it was based, the whole education system in America was based on a Prussian model, to create, obviously, an obedient workforce. And he says the way he kind of is okay with being a teacher, was okay with being a teacher, was that every morning when he's shaving in the mirror, he say to himself, I'm going to throw some dirt in the machinery of the system, throw some sand in the cogs, so that within the system, if you're going to be working in the system, you're trying to make things better for people who are caught up in it. Because obviously I come from, I see a lot of what's wrong with education, with this, or schooling, this schooling, the machinations of it and what it does to young people's ideas of learning and what they perceive as education and creative thinking.
Could you provide any specific examples? Like you've been sitting there one day and then something happens, or you see these kids being taught one thing and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah, I mean, it's an everyday thing. So, I mean, before I was like working as, assisting in classes for a couple of years, mixing up the sports coaching and being in a classroom where the teacher's teaching the national curriculum. And teachers, essentially, they got a difficult job. They're teaching a wide variety of subjects superficially, of which they have little understanding. That's the nature of the job. You know, one day you got to teach them algebra. Next day you got to teach them a bit of history or some grammar. So, in general, a teacher, like I'm talking like younger, like primary school teachers, so it's not specialist subjects. Maybe the day before they'll brush up on it and then teach it, but that means they're not motivated to teach that subject. They're not thrown over love for that subject.
They're doing it because they have to.
It's their job. And often, with the school system, you have kids arbitrarily thrown together based on one idea that they were all born within 1 year. And that's the one thing that they have in common, which is an unnatural situation. So you have a wide variety of abilities and interests within this, class of 30, which is already quite a big class, for a lot of these teachers to handle. And essentially they end up pitching their lesson probably to, the more, I wouldn't say intelligent, but the more, knowledgeable, say 10% of the class. And even for them, often it's over their head, but they know how to answer the questions. And the rest of the kids are playing a game of kind of stay hidden. Don't get caught in that spotlight of the teacher asking you a question you don't know what the hell is going on, because it's way too abstract and it hasn't been contextualized with anything, and you're expected to know this. So a lot of kids are playing a game of just stay below the radar and keep moving. It's a data, as a general thing I see, is pretty depressing. And that's why I decided the only way I'm going to stay in the system is if I'm dictating the curriculum I teach and what I'm doing. But in the future, essentially I might be able to work in a more freelance way where I offer a service to to organizations or schools, and they can pay me rather than being directly employed by the government.
And when you were a kid going to school, did you fit in really well?
I did, yeah. Initially, I think, you know, I was sporty, so I was one of the best footballers, best tennis players that wins you a lot of kudos. Mm-hmm. And I was quite smart, so I kind of sailed through it.
I think that's actually a different experience to a lot of people in this movement, I'd suppose. All right, well, we'll get into more of this after the break.
All right.
Ivan Owen is my guest. Is there a website that people can go and listen to your music by chance?
Yes, Ogmios, O-G-M-I-O-S .bandcamp.com.
All right, you can back in a minute.
Last album.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest, Ivan Owen. The website is ogmios.bandcamp.com. That's ogmios.bandcamp.com. What does that even mean?
Well, basically, yeah, you can call me Ogmios, by the way. That's like my my rapper name or artist name. Basically, Ogmios is a Celtic god of eloquence and persuasion. Basically years ago, looking through one of my old books on mythological characters, stumbled across this guy who's he's also a bald god as well, like me. I'm follically challenged. There's not a lot of bald gods out there. So yeah, and plus for a rapper, seemed like an appropriate kind of aspiration to have Ogmios as my name.
All right. Well, without further ado, let's get one of your songs played, eh? I think this one's called, Magic Money Machine featuring Singer Blue.
Yeah.
Let's see if I can get this puppy rigged up here.
Took his bottle from the corner of the mantelpiece and his hypodermic syringe from its neat Morocco case. With his long, nervous fingers, he adjusted the delicate needle and rolled back his left shirt cuff. For some time, his eyes...
Oh, no. What the heck happened there?
I think it skipped.
Let's try that one again, shall we?
Let's do it.
Sherlock Holmes took his bottle from the corner of the mantelpiece and his hypodermic syringe from its neat Morocco case. With his long, nervous fingers, he adjusted the delicate needle and rolled back his left shirt cuff. For some time, his eyes rested thoughtfully upon the sinewy forearm and wrist, all dotted and scarred with innumerable puncture marks. Finally, he thrust the sharp point home, pressed down the tiny piston, and sank back into the velvet-lined armchair with a long sigh of satisfaction. Which is it today, morphine or cocaine? It is cocaine. Would you care to try it? I sprang from my chair. Steve had lit his pipe again and was leaning back with drooping eyelids.
I'm the great-great-grandson of Sherlock Holmes. I'm steeped in this business, it's deep in my bones. I could solve theft, murder, treason, whatever crime happens to be in season. But times are hard for this private eye. I sit around the office and spark another pipe, lean back in my chair and send the smoke high, and analyze the vapors in my logical mind. As I scan the papers and read the headlines, I see we're all living in turbulent times. Economic system designed to collapse and bring fat cat bailouts while jobs get axed. As in banksters, bonuses, they build their sacks, while the onus is on us to pay more tax. These criminal minds promoting infinite debts is the kind of thing that really tends to get me so vexed. I need to see my dealer so I can stressed, but my money situation is far from blessed. So I call up my dear friend Watson the Fourth to see if he wants to go hard on the sport. He says no, but he'll come out anyway for a nice gentle stroll on such a lovely day. We walk to the cash point and that's when it starts, cause it laughs in my face and spits at my card.
Before God knows,
where's my money gone? Where's my funny money gone? Your flunky machine monkey must have his numbers wrong. Muster up the mustard, expose Chris coupons. I lose my custom to the holes in my futon. A revolution, it's not a new con. We win now, we lose some to crooks with the suits on. City of London, home of phantom phenomena. Where's my money gone? Where's my funny money gone? Where's my money been? Funny how it came to be something out of nothing. Big damn theory. I'd rather barter with herbs and magic beans than deal with these cursed coins of a royal travesty. Really, I'm just mad at me. With each fix of your morphine, I'm more of a fiend. But bring forth the filthy lucre that I need, and I swear I'm gonna go clean.
The cunning rascal. I can tell you, Watson, this time I've been checkmated.
I'm searching for clues around the crime scene, examining cigarette butts and old bank receipts. All my leads turning up at their den, but just then, a well-dressed man joins the queue for the ATM. Watson, I believe that's Hugo Oberstein, one of the banks that overlords a fraud mastermind. It's no coincidence that he happens to be here. We must act quick, I feel my money is near. I maneuver with the stealth of a ninja assassin. Look over his shoulder as he puts in his pin. He checks his balance and gets a mini statement, so we follow him a little further up the pavement while Watson distracts him. I dip inside his bag, remove his wallet and a packet of fags. Now Watson, let's test my hypothesis. Take his card, see what the most you can withdraw is. Yes, it pays at the maximum. It's in cahoots with those filling the scum. Part of the paper conspiracy, keeping the ball poor. We'll come back later, vandalize it some more. It can't hook with me, I know what's going on. As you can well testify, my dear Watson, this is one for your scrapbook, another case solved. Now let's hop footing to the payphone.
Hugo Oberstein.
Where's my money gone? Where's my funny money gone? Your flunky machine monkey must have his numbers wrong. Muster up the mustard, expose Chris coupons. I lose my custom to the holes in my futon. A revolution, it's not a new con. We win now, we lose some to crooks with the suits on. City of London, home of phantom phenomena. Where's my money gone? Where's my funny money gone?
Where's my money gone?
Where's my money been? Funny how it came to be something out of nothing. Big damn theory. I'd rather barter with her. Herbs and magic beans and deal with these cursed coins of a royal travesty. Really, I'm just mad at me. With each fix of your morphine, I'm more of a fiend. But bring forth the filthy lucre that I need, and I swear I'm gonna go clean.
Things are turning in our direction at last.
Spend it.
Where's my money gone?
I'm going out now. I'll get my hat. No, I'm going alone. If time hangs heavy, get your paper and your pen and begin the story of how we saved the state.
Where's my money going?
All right, there we go.
Yeah,
it's a good song, man.
Thanks, man.
I got a mate named Calvin Alp, and he set up the Solomon Islands government, and he was trying to help out with the New Zealand government's funny money problems, and
yeah,
and trying to talk about debt-free currency. And he says, "Well, if that's what you call funny money, then whatever money we've got now is freaking hilarious." You know, it's obscene the amount of coin that gets stolen. It's like, I don't know about you, but I feel we're this close to a cashless society. And the reason I know that is because everybody's out of cash.
Yeah, definitely. You don't need cash. I'm even wondering, you know, like on a certain level, like you think, oh, you know, I might keep a little cash You know, I make a modest income, but I'm talking like a few hundred quid, maybe keep a little cash like somewhere in case of, you know, there's a run on the banks or whatever. But for how long would that be worth anything? I don't know. I guess it's one thing to try maybe, but by the time anything happens, it's like, well, where are you going to go with your money? You might get something in the first, like, short time after, but I don't know. Yeah, and there's, yeah, definitely see less cash around.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe in the final days of destruction, you might be able to pick yourself up an Adidas track suit for a steal. England riot styles.
That's right, yeah. You know about the London riots, yeah. But that's the thing.
That was quite funny. I heard my mate in England telling me about that, and he's just like, these geezers. It's just a bunch of young chavs come thiefing off with the latest Adidas stuff and cheap red wine from the bottle stores that they knocked in.
Yeah, that part was crazy. But you know what? I was there to observe in my area, Hackney, near where, you know, in the nearby borough of Haringey's where Mark Duggan was shot by police, which was the spark of the whole riots, because he was pulled over, he was in a cab, and it seems like he may have been, you know, it's alleged he was executed pretty much by police, and then there was a gun maybe in the car or something. They put the gun somewhere, claimed he had a gun, but that was a spot for the riot in Tottenham, because there's, you know, general unhappiness towards the police because of the way they've been treating people, especially poor people, especially so-called ethnic minority people. So in the areas near where it sparked off, it was, I'm not saying it wasn't looting, but a lot of it was aimed at police. A lot of it was justified anger coming up. And when, as it spread across, obviously there's just a lot of looting for mindless objects, looting Argos, looting, you know, these, you know, some people are doing prison times now, are doing years now for taking a packet of Maltesers, you know, something ridiculous and just stupidity, and they've been caught in a trap. But I wouldn't like that. I don't like to hear that the right, you know, for the riots to be painted just as mindless activities. There was that, you know, people jumping on that, but there was anger at police, basically. That was the initial aspect of it.
See, me, I've got a lot of anger for police. I've had a lot of run-ins with them, and they're not nice people a lot of the time. I mean, like, occasionally you'll get a real nice one.
Yeah.
Who will just give you a small ticket. You know, like, that's about as best as you can do. I could give you a $180 ticket, but I'm only going to give you a $60 ticket. And go, well, thank you. Thank you, Slave Master. Like, that's thinking positive.
Yeah. There's small favors, you know. It's like, I don't know what to say to that. I don't know what the police are like. You're in New Zealand, yeah?
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure, you know, it's a similar thing all around the world.
Well, let me put it this way. About half the cops that I encounter are from England.
Really?
So they're practically the same police force, mate.
Well, they're actually from England?
Yep. They got the accent and the Bobby on the beat attitude and everything.
And they've immigrated to New Zealand?
Yep.
Wow, that's interesting.
Plane, mostly.
Yeah. Not in the ships, yeah.
Yeah. Well, in fact, speaking of planes, we were talking about 9/11. It's sort of like the gateway drug of the truth of movement. And it's just thinking, you know, oh, man, that's dustification right there. Oh, that's pretty amazing. Is there anything harder around here, man? And it's like, yeah, man, the truth is very addictive, I've found. You got that point in your life where you're like, man, this stuff is intensely interesting. And you spend hours and hours a day watching YouTube documentaries or reading articles and things of that nature. And you're thinking, man, how can I contribute to this in my own way? Yeah. And you've seemed to pick music as more your forte. Did you come from a musical family or anything?
No, not really. I played some instruments when I was younger, and I've always liked to write. So hip hop is the perfect kind of medium for me. Whereas in the way that it's a mixture of making music and composing poetry to go with that music. I would say I'm not very often overtly political in my writing, because I always want the creativity to be the main driving force. And there are some political rappers, and, you know, some of them are great. I don't, you know, Low Key in England is a very well known political rapper. I don't know if you know him.
I've heard of him and sent him a request to come on the show. No replies. He's that popular, I guess.
Yeah, he's very well known. I'm not sure if he's still doing much rapping, but he's he's very overtly political. But for me, I find sometimes if it's too, you know, some political rappers will try and condense too much information and statistics and bend it to rhyme, you know, so they're unloading information. So the information that they're unloading becomes the main kind of important thing in what they're saying, rather than the poetic side. And for me, I don't ever want that to be the case, where I'm just listing information or statistics. It has to come from a creative point. And also, I think there's many ways to carry that political message without just saying this is bad, this is bad, this is bad, or this is, in more subtle and interesting ways in terms of hip-hop and generally in music and writing.
Yeah, well, I've noticed that music is one of the most influential factors in people's lives, really. It's just, there's something about resonant frequencies that kind of penetrate the blood-brain barrier or something, I guess is the best way I can describe it, you know? Like, it brings your guard down and allows more light to really shine through, I think, on your dark, gooey brain places. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Ogmios.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that is all about history repeating. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I wonder if there's been like some kind of like ancient Vinnie Eastwood, you know, making crappy puns and stuff like that along some sort of like a string between two cans wire thing, like back in the 1880s or something, passing secret messages between dangerous, you know, otherwise unbeknownst secret military tribunal frickin' musket cleaning bootleggers of some kind, you know. There must be some kind of...
Definitely.
I don't know where I was going with that at all. It just became awesome as soon as I mentioned bootlegging, I think.
Definitely. I think it's entirely possible. I like to entertain many possibilities, just, you know, rather than discount anything.
Yeah.
I would say...
Maybe that'd be a good business practice, you know, in a retail store, you know. Somebody asks you, what's the price of that? And it goes, well, I entertain many possibilities, but I don't discount anything.
That would be great.
You want those cross trainers, mate? Full price. What anyway, we got the idea here that the truth movement is a really difficult thing to sort of break into people's minds, really, unless they're really open to it in the first place. And I found what happens is you're usually open to it because you've seen a whole lot of real nasty stuff kind of thing, and you're like, for a while. And then eventually a few sources will come along and people will, and this information will sort of click for you, and it just goes, you know what? Oh, my God. And the penny drops. And for you, that penny was Alan Watt, wasn't it?
Alan Watts. Because Alan Watt is someone else, isn't he? He's because it's Alan Watt, who I believe is on the truth kind of thing. But Alan Watts, as in the 1960s, 70s Zen, kind of Zen master, who was one of the foremost people bringing Zen Buddhism, ideas of Zen Buddhism to the West. So it's his books and ideas of Zen, which are like a total, you know, opposite kind of way of looking at things than the Western, a lot of the Western traditional kind of reductionist mechanical way of looking at things scientifically, in that sense. And it was, yeah, obviously that Eastern philosophy vibe that really started me off wanting to explore that kind of way of thinking in different ways, and not being attached to certain ideas and opinions as fixed all the time. So, you know, even in conversations, learning to not be trying to defend a position when I'm discussing something with people. You know, we go around often, we engage in, you know, if I try and discuss certain things with people, it ends up with them trying to defend something, or, you know, just unload information. Whereas the best discussions or conversations I have with people is where we're both building. That's why I like the term building. They use that a lot in certain movements. They say, you know, we're going to sit down, we're going to build, because we're building on what each other's saying, and we're ready to put our egos aside and be ready to say, oh, yeah, that's right. Because if you've got an idea that's been proved wrong, or, you know, a bit dodgy, you should rejoice, because that means you're moving from an area of, you know, ignorance to greater knowledge and understanding. So I think it's so important is how we, you know, especially in these times, is how we move forward in our communication with each other. And, you know, we live in a time, even now, you know, I'm on a radio show, I feel slightly rushed, if I'm honest, you know, it's like, but obviously the format dictates that I keep talking, but sometimes, you know, I like to have a big pause and have a little think about things. But, you know, even, you know, when you see, like, these question time shows that we have over here, or what passes for political debate is unbelievable. It's just nothing. There's nothing there. And I read this book.
You ever find yourself yelling at the television sometimes?
No, what? Well, I don't even watch half of it, to be honest. I mean, I don't have a TV. I watch some bits on the internet, but anything I end up yelling at, I wouldn't watch it. I stop watching it because it's honestly beneath me. Why am I sitting there yelling at something? Why don't just turn it off and read a book, or phone up a friend and have a decent conversation and decent building session, decent exchange of ideas, and see where it leads us.
It's like, hold on a second, these people can't hear me.
Right.
It's not a CB radio. The transmission does not go two ways.
Yeah. Definitely. For me, yeah, it's just a waste of energy, like directing anything towards what's going on, you know, on TV and in media. That's just a whole separate madness.
Although, there's something I have enjoyed lately is watching the news with my missus Sarah, and we both yell at the TV together and yell at each other over how crazy what's on the TV is.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you're with someone, yeah, I mean, because you can kind of bounce off each other, and that's a bit better. Yeah, But yeah, it's, I guess could be better. Yeah, or unless it's just both of you ranting at the TV.
it is funny. Like I don't know, you'll see some sort of I think it was a Tampax commercial, and there was this girl levitating, right, like on her back on the top of an Incan pyramid with a giant pyramid of light detached from the base of the Incan pyramid hovering above her with these light rays coming out at it, and we were both like, "What the f-?"
That's that deep symbology right there, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I have to say, I'm not really, like, I know a lot of people want to look out for these triangles and eyes and stuff. I'm not really into the whole symbology thing, personally. You know, I just think, you know, or people looking at hand gestures given out by rappers or politicians, I don't buy it. I just think a triangle is a triangle to a degree, and like there's better ways to spend your energy than analyzing it that closely.
Yeah, like Jordan Maxwell told me, you get what you pay for, and whatever you start to focus on, that's what's going to start really infecting your life.
Right.
And obsessing about the occult can really, really mess you up.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember a lot of people were freaking out over the London Olympics, how they had those 13 Illuminati all-seeing eye pyramid towers, the lighting towers, you know?
Yeah.
I thought that was particularly interesting with all the occult symbolism of the opening ceremony and all of that kind of stuff. But it's like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
If you say so.
Mm. Yeah.
Because you don't really know what it means, and if you don't know what it means, what the hell is the point in focusing on it unless you're actually trying to figure it out?
That's right, yeah. And at the end of the day, the stuff itself is neutral. You know what I mean? The triangle is neutral. I don't think there's anything inherently kind of evil or wrong about symbols or this or that. There might be associations that we don't know about, but they might have been appropriated, you know. Certain, like, the swastika was appropriated from, what, Hindu traditions. So it's not the swastika symbol that is evil. It's the associations or the, you know, that people, you know, I don't want to focus on.
Yeah. Well, anyway... That symbol is the symbol of the sun, and Hitler decided that he was a hardcore occultist, loved the dark black magic, and in dark black magic, what you do is you just reverse things that are good, and then automatically they mean something evil. So instead of a swastika which points to the right, you know, with all the things going around in a circle, I think anti-clockwise, he did it the other way, to the left. And... and hence becomes a great occult symbol for all of this. They're totally obsessed with that kind of stuff. There's a there's a big, big research community out there talking about Nazi occultism and all of that kind of thing. So, and here's an interesting thing about the occult. It's like, even if guys like you and I don't believe in it, people like that actually really do believe in it. And not only do they believe in it, they're willing to act on it. You know, that's the real scary stuff.
Yeah, that's it. It's all the negativity is coming from them. You know, they try and attach things to symbols or elements, but it's all coming from them. That negative energy you can feel that surrounds these people.
Yeah, they're just bad dudes, really. And you don't want bad dudes in your life.
Nah,
get some good friends, good family.
Yeah, be careful about the company you keep, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. Especially if it's Halliburton. All right. Ogvios, thank you very much for coming on the show with me today, man. It's been a pleasure and an honor and various other nice adjectives.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome, man. And ladies and gentlemen, you can go and listen to his whole album. I did. Ogmios.bandcamp.com. That's ogmios.bandcamp.com. We'll see you back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. for all. Welcome. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. You know, life is a really, really interesting thing because it's got so much variation to it. And speaking of variation, we're going to bring on a regular guest now, Suzanne Posel. I know the irony of that. Yes, I realize it. I am an irony man. Much like a black sand beach. And also, we've got caller line open. So if anybody would like to call in and comment on the news of the day or anything else you freaking well feel like. Really? Are you down in the dumps? You've had some scumbaggery or something in your life. You hate your boss. You're about to pop an SSRI drug and do a murder suicide or something. Call into the show. We'll set you right. Suzanne Posel, welcome.
Hello, everyone. I think
I just lightly polished on the SSRI drug murder suicide phenomenon. How the hell do I do this thing?
I ask you all the time. I wish I could come up with a quip the way that you do. You're going to have to show me how, because I always think about something cool to say about an hour after the whole incident is over.
Honestly, I don't know how. I think I was just born really messed up.
Just really sardonic in a very humorous way. Most people go to school to train to be that. You're just naturally that way.
Yeah. Isn't that awful? All right. Speaking of awful times, we have our first caller in the line right away. Probably an SSRI killer in the making. Ernie in California. You got your guns locked and cocked?
Oh, man. You know it, Benny. At least we get to keep ours. I don't know about New Zealand.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll see about that.
Yeah. If Diane Feinstein has her way, nobody's going to have guns.
Well, they already, a gentleman went to a mental health facility for 2 days, and they raided his house 2 days later and took his gun. So it's going to start, but you know what? I think the globalists, the Illuminati, world order, what do you want to call them? I think they're really underestimating Americans. I know they have, you know, 2 billion hollow points. They just ordered 2,700 RVs, I call them, basically RVs, you know, bomb-resistance vehicles with flames that shoot out the side. And I just want to wake up. I live with a sheep who will sit there and stare at that frickin' CNN, that MSNBC, mind control, glued to it, and you cannot wake these people up. So my point is, how do you wake up somebody who went through the liberal college, brainwashed as a liberal? How do you even approach them?
Well, first thing you can do is you can call the cops on them and make up a manufactured story. And then when the cops come in, bust them for absolutely no reason and taser them, then they'll be really suspicious of the cops all of a sudden. Then they'll be open to whatever you're telling them.
You can't do that.
I have taser marks to prove that one.
You got taser marks, yo.
Yeah, I've been tased. I got 2 scars. I've been there for 2 years, and I don't think they're going to come out. But hey, I want to thank you, Vinny. I think you do an awesome job. Because you do put a spin of happiness on what is really a bleak thing. I live in Central California, and they chemtrail the heck out of us. So right now, I'm doing some, I got some non-GMO seeds and planted them. I got the roots going up. And I found out there's a soil out here. I don't know the name of it. I don't want to promote anybody. But it takes the hot particles and holds them in the soil and doesn't let them go up into the plant. So I'm going to research and find out if it's true, because living in California, I will not let my kid out in the rain. I know what the rain here is, acidy, and put it this way, got probably cesium, strontium, and who knows whatever else in it. So So I just want to thank you for enlightening me and making me laugh in a world that is so sick.
Well, you know, you're welcome. I experience a lot of the laughter of this show too. You know, I'm not just making these jokes to make other people laugh. I don't really care whether or not other people laugh, Ernie, to tell you the truth. I'm just here to amuse myself, and if other people want to be amused too, that's freaking awesome.
I've got you, Nate. Thank you very much. I'll keep this in the show, and everybody, just try to wake up the friends. I know, especially the Bible thumpers, they're the hardest. You know, I feel bad for them. I was an Roman Catholic, altar boy, Jehovah's Witness, and boy, that's some really good mind control. Wow. Other than that, wish you the best, my brother, and love to all of you.
Thanks, man. Okay, now we have my second hour guest has actually now arrived, Michael Sherlock, I believe. AFR, if you're there, could you please bring him up into the chat there? Sorry, Suzanne, we haven't had much of a chance to talk. My guest has turned up.
No, that's wonderful.
Well, we're waiting for him, on the other hand. Is there any news you'd like to share?
I wrote an article about how the mainstream media is demonizing patriots, claiming that they're going to set off a second Oklahoma City attack. That's a very big story. Wrote an article about Dianne Feinstein and her comments that all veterans are mentally incompetent and they should not have any provisions in her assault weapons ban bill for 2013. That they retain the right to keep their guns. They should all have them all removed because they could be potentially mentally deranged or have, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, TBI, all those things. I just got done writing an article that'll go up tomorrow. The U.S. Navy has come out and said that because of man-made climate change, there's a threat to national security as far as the armed forces go. So we need to find ways to combat. And they actually have a task force that they set up in 2009 just specifically for the U.S. Navy in regard to climate change and how to combat it. It's very interesting. So look for that article, OccupyCorporatism.com, tomorrow morning.
We still have another 2 minutes as well before while my guest is getting ready. There's been a, as I mentioned on the radio the last couple of days, is that the US time zone's just taken on daylight savings, and so that actually has a physical effect when we're talking from the southern hemisphere, like a whole hour shifts back. So instead of doing the show midday till 2 p.m., it's actually like 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. So my guest thought he was going to be coming on next hour, and so he thinks he's here early. Sorry, mate, you're actually here late. Yeah, and that's the funny thing.
It should be an interesting interview. I'm having him on, I believe, at the end of the month. He wrote a very interesting book about belief and the power of belief and how it makes people do things that it shifts their personal paradigm to get them to do things that they wouldn't normally do.
What, police?
Well, police do that, yes, but how belief and that whole mind system that goes into believing in something. Once you commit to a belief, how it affects you psychologically and then the choices that you make because of that.
Mm. Well, you know, I think belief's a double-edged sword, kind of like technology. You know what I'm saying? You can either believe that doing the right thing involves killing innocent people, or you can believe that the right thing is saving innocent people from death. And both people sincerely hold their beliefs. And I think what people forget is that if people are willing to act on their beliefs, it does affect you, even if you don't believe or what they do. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of society that we're living in now. It's just this contest of beliefs, and people think that that it doesn't really exist or whatever until they get blown up or something.
Right. Think about how the beliefs that we were brought up with affect us, and then once we come to realize that everything we were told was not true or a version of the truth, going back and looking at how we were raised and what ideals our parents instilled in us and what that means once you realize that what is really going on, how that shifts your paradigm. That's very shocking.
Now, at the moment, we're kind of very tight-lipped, you know, there's things going on in the background that are stressing the both of us out. We don't really want to mention it on air. And just in terms of stress and things of that nature, how difficult is it really for you writing articles every day and raising a family on a shoestring budget?
Well, my husband and I shifted what we think is important several years ago, about 7 years ago, when we got on this organic farm in Colorado and lived there for 5 years. And you do without a lot of the modern necessities. And it's very quiet out there at night, and you can actually sleep and hear the animals. These things affect you, living with the cycle of the day and the night and getting up in the sunrise and going to bed at sunset. All of these things affect you, and so we don't have a need for extravagant excess. We care more about the quality of the time that we spend together than the toys that we can purchase. So being on a shoestring budget doesn't bother us because that's the lifestyle that we choose to live. What our ideals hold for us. But I love what I do, absolutely love what I do, and I love the fact that I've been able to meet so many wonderful people because of it, not just radio hosts like yourself, but also I have listeners and readers that I give my cell phone number to when we talk, and I get to meet all these great people that I would have normally gotten a chance to meet. So I absolutely love what I do, and my husband is very supportive. And the children, during the day, the day is for the children. I homeschool my son from 9 until noon, and then we go out and we play in the park and we spend time together. And I make that a point. Everything I do for the website happens at night, and because I love what I do, I stay up till all hours of the night. But it's a very rich and rewarding life that I've built for myself, and it's because of the fact that I got into the alternative media, and my whole family structure has shifted, and what we believe in and what we hold dear has shifted. So it's actually a really wonderful thing that all of this has happened.
Well, I think you learn to appreciate different things because you're forced to recognize that most of the things you used to appreciate, most of the things you used to strive for in your life and try to do, don't actually matter.
Yes, absolutely. All the way down to, you know, what type of shoes you wear, whether or not you bought the latest toy. None of that matters. We go to the park, we go to the zoo, we go to museums, we go to art shows, we go to local where people play local bands. We enjoy our time. We'll go out as a family to the park and just wander around for 3 hours and let the kids explore and have a good time. We don't ever go to the mall. We don't ever go to pre-designated areas where they, you know, you pay to have a good time.
Yeah. You know, this reminds me of when I was a flashy salesman and I had a belt buckle that was like half the size of my face, and it was like in a big, you know, American dollar sign. And it was like all encrusted with, these cubic zirconias kind of thing, you know. The belt buckle itself cost me like well over $100.
Wow.
You know, just thinking about it, you know, man, how much of a douchebag was I walking around with this freaking thing that could like rival the sun when light reflected off it? It's just insane.
No. You weren't a douchebag. You didn't know any better, and you were trying to do what you thought was right.
Actually, I was trying to do what I thought looked cool.
Well, yes, exactly, because you think that you have to fit in, and if you don't look a certain way, you're not going to. The wonderful positive aspect of waking up is that those things don't matter, and you can actually look at the things that do matter and start to appreciate them, and who cares? If something breaks, you go and replace it. However, you're not tied to keeping up with the Joneses anymore. That frees you. It's such a relief.
Yeah, as it were, the pressure comes off. Now, we have our special guest for this hour turning up now, Michael Sherlock. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me, Vincent. I do apologize for being late. My publicist was, I think, got the times a little confused.
No, I think it's just more like we had this time zone change. You know, daylight savings in the States happens, and then everything gets shifted back by an hour. So I assumed that you'd probably turn up in the second hour at some point, but I didn't know exactly when. Well, anyway, we're about a minute and a half from break. So if you want to just quickly give us a capsule review of just who you are and what you do before we go to that, and then we'll get into the interview right after.
Sure. I'm an author who's published a book called I Am Christ, The Crucifixion Painful Truth. And that book is the first volume in a 3-volume series. And it is an attack on the Christian religion or the Christian belief system and an attack on the significance we place on belief itself. And so in the book, I run through belief from the social psychological perspective. I look at belief from the neuroscientific perspective. I also talk about what I call a psychological phoenix, and that's the burning of one's beliefs, the giving up of one's beliefs in order to become a little bit more enlightened. Then I go into an attack on the Christian Gospels, which are the foundation of the Christian belief system, these 4 Gospels that were selected by the Proto-Orthodox Church, and I show that they have a lot of contradictions, they're not exactly historical. And so that's basically what the first volume deals with. It also looks at the historical Jesus question and showing that there's not really much historical evidence for a character named Jesus that was described in the Gospels. And so, yeah.
All right. Well, it's remarkably synchronistic because that was exactly what we were talking about how people's beliefs affect you, even if you don't believe it, kind of thing, and how you can wake people up to reality if they don't know what the heck it is, sort of thing. So this will be interesting. We'll be right back.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know
Welcome
about
back.
The greed of uranium and the mortar? What you know about...
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about the fluoride in your water and the depleted uranium in the mortar. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. From the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chains nation and the sunny slave South Pacific, my very special guest, guests, plural, Michael Sherlock and Suzanne Posel is just going to be sitting in. Now, there's a bit of a synchronicity thing happening here, and it happens on occasion. In fact, it happens every single day with me. There'll be some kind of synchronistic, like, oh, that's meant to be. So we were talking about belief structures and all of this kind of stuff, and then Michael comes on and he's talking about all these Christian-based belief structures and things like that. Incidentally, exactly the thing that we were talking about. And incidentally, Suzanne Posel is going to be interviewing him, like, what, next week? Is it Suzanne?
It's the last Thursday in this month. He's going to be out for the 2 hours. Yeah.
I'll try not to be late for your one, Susan.
Okay.
Yeah, so there you go, ladies and gentlemen. There's this little trifecta of synchronicity McThingamajigger going on here. Anyway, Michael, would you please be able to explain us what your perspective is on the Christian religion and belief structures and things like that? Because I'll just preface this with my concern about it is that there's a book of laws, right? It's called the Bible. It's only like this big, you know, it's not that thick. Whereas if you read the Patriot Act, it's about 10 times as thick as the Bible. Which laws do you want to follow, you know? The other side of it is just general rules for life, you know? Don't be a douchebag. Don't kill no motherfucker. You know, just some simple things that make life actually much easier for everybody, especially the people that rule over you who don't have to worry about you attacking them or killing them because your beliefs prohibit you from attacking the people who are killing you.
Yeah. Well, I think that for me, there are a number of problems with the emphasis we place on our beliefs. And I think I need to qualify this statement as well, because belief is a natural aspect of the mind. We can't escape it entirely. For example, I believe tomorrow will come. I don't know tomorrow will come. I believe it will come. But if I didn't believe tomorrow would come, I couldn't organize my life. So beliefs can be very practical, they can be very helpful, and also they can give us a sense of order. So they are important as well, but like everything in life, they're dualistic in nature. That is, they have another side to them. And this is the side that social psychologists have been pointing out, that neuroscientists have been pointing out, and that is they are inextricably linked with A, our ego, and B, our emotions. So because they're very emotional in nature, when we adopt a belief, or and what I'll call an unjustified belief in Platonic terms, something that we cannot go very far in proving, something that we believe without evidence, Jesus came back from the dead, Muhammad spoke with Gabriel the angel, Obama is for hope and change. When we have these, we develop these kind of beliefs, we take them and they get rooted in our mind. They anchored down in our mind by emotion. And once we've adopted the belief, our mind employs, employs strategies to keep that belief intact. And it will fight tooth and nail to keep those beliefs intact, regardless of the evidence, regardless of the truth. But I think that truth, in my opinion, truth is much more important than my beliefs. And we need to find a way to ascend beyond belief-based thinking or unthinking, as I call it. And this is what the Crucifixion, Painful Truths chapter of Volume 1 is all about. It's about ascending beyond emotional interpretations of the truth and getting to a more enlightened state of mind where we will not be manipulated by our beliefs. We will not manipulate ourselves, more importantly, you know, via our beliefs. And so Volume 1 is concerned with highlighting beliefs, what they are, the emotional nature of beliefs. So I go into the what I call the three primary emotional elements of belief, and that is the inheritance factor. That is, we inherit, especially with regards to religious beliefs, even political beliefs, they're inherited. They're a socially contracted virus, if you like. We get them off others, okay? We get them off our parents, close friends, whatever, okay? So they're socially contractible, they're inherited.
Socially transmitted disease, like an STD?
Exactly right, yeah, exactly right, for the mind. and they can be quite devastating to the mind, in my opinion, as well. I mean, they can cause people to live a whole life asleep, basically, on autopilot. Whereas their whole world view, the whole way they view the world and their meaning and purpose and everything in life, the possibilities they're capable of, what they're not capable of, are all determined by these beliefs. So essentially the person has become the puppet of the belief. And so in my book, I use as an analogy, I analogize that Judas from the Gospels is our belief. And the Christ in the Gospels, this mythological character, Christ in the Gospels, is the higher self, the self that's willing to undertake the crucifixion in I'm speaking symbolically only, of the mind, the crucifixion of the mind, because that's what it is when we have to overcome our beliefs. We undergo a crucifixion of the mind. It's very painful to look at a long-held belief that you've had and say, all right, well, I think that belief is flawed and I've been wrong. So, as I mentioned before, there's the inheritance factor. We inherit these things. So when people attack our beliefs, we take it indirectly, either consciously or subconsciously, as an attack on the person who we receive that belief from. So, well, my father taught me to believe in Christ and he's the only way. And now this person is attacking my belief in Christ. Well, by proxy, they're attacking my father. And what are you calling my father, stupid? He believes it. He taught me. It must be the truth. But the truth isn't determined by your teacher, the person who you contract this belief from. Also, there's the ego factor, which the second element I talk about in the book. The ego factor is a massive factor, and it's something that psychologists and social psychologists have pointed out. That our
that's something
views
I found.
The world,
yeah, that's something I found very interesting. Is that the fundamentalist Christian belief in the word of God gets just as egoically and emotionally engaged in as atheists' disbelief in religion and God. I found that particularly interesting that they will both obsess. They will both obsess and not listen based upon their belief structure, whereas one of them believes something and one of them claims to not believe something, and they still go about it the exact same way.
Well, I make this point in the book as well. That's an excellent point you're raising, that disbelief can be just as misleading as belief itself. And so generally what we believe will impact on what we don't or cannot believe, because it will want to set up a shield, and that shield is often disbelief, and that disbelief can take the form of a disconfirmation bias with regards to information, with regards to other beliefs. But for me, I think if I had to choose, well, do you want to be a believer in God or do you want to be an atheist? I would choose atheism in the sense that there are many atheists who don't say, well, there is no God. There are many atheists who say that we don't know there's a God. There could be a God, it's possible, but we haven't been presented with sufficient evidence to make a conclusion.
And I thought that was called agnostic.
Yeah, agnostic is in that sense, yes, but atheist just generally means, it comes from the Greek term, atheist, meaning without God, without a God. It doesn't necessarily mean you disbelieve categorically that a God exists. It means that you just want to follow the evidence, and if the evidence isn't sufficient to make a conclusion, you won't make a conclusion. And that's, I guess, where I lay between atheism and agnosticism somewhere. But I don't like to, I'd never call myself an atheist, I'd never call myself an agnostic, I don't call myself an Australian. The only thing I call myself, I guess, is stupid sometimes when I make a mistake. But
because that at least you can find some evidence on.
That's right. I can conclude, I have evidence that I am stupid sometimes. Yeah, that's right.
I do that myself, you know. I just think to myself, man, Vinny is so stupid, and I deny it, and I go, no, I'm not that stupid, and I go, you are stupid, I have the documents.
that's getting into schizophrenia, but that's not too bad. We're all a little bit schizophrenic. And actually, in my book, in the beginning, I raise an example in the foreword of my book. My father was a drug and alcohol counselor in Sydney, and one of his clients was a schizophrenic who was a very successful stockbroker before he had a schizophrenic episode. And that episode cost him his job and then led to a nasty drug habit or cocaine habit. And I remember my father would come home and tell me all about this guy, and he was fascinated with this client of his, this schizophrenic guy. And he used to say that he just had the most amazing opinions and perceptions in the world around him, things he'd never thought before. And so my father used to say that I think there may be some evidence to say that 9 times out of 10, the people in this world we deem crazy are actually the sane ones, and the people we deem sane are insane. And like at first I was like, okay, I think Dad's losing it. I think he should stop hanging around this schizophrenic guy. But then he explained it, and he said, well, we live in a world that's full of poverty, famine, war, totally unnecessary suffering that goes on in this world as a result of complacency, the chronic dependency of the masses. And we all go about our lives without blinking an eye. We most people will say, well, you know, I'll give the homeless some thought today, but then I'm going to go back to watching TV, The Price is Right is on, or The Wheel of Fortune, whatever is on. So they can live knowing that this is going on right now to their fellow human beings, that children are starving to death, that mothers are watching their children die in wars that are politically and religiously motivated. They can just live their life on this thin veneer of what we call sanity. But the person who we deem insane is the person who says, no, I can't live in this insanity. And they exhibit what we call an insane response. But the insane response is to the insanity that they're countering. So if you look at it, the response is matching the insanity. It's an appropriate response to the world that we're living in. And so, yeah, I guess there's that part of it. I don't want to make people think I'm too crazy, but yeah.
I don't know about you, But as a proud conspiracy theorist, I have been, you know, and I believe a conspiracy theorist means somebody who believes that there are powerful people who have a lot of influence, who use their power and influence to maintain it, you know, or grow it. Mm. That's my simple definition for it. I've been called very, very many times a crazy person or paranoid or something of that nature. And what's interesting to me is that I know that I'm not crazy. And I know that I'm not paranoid. And so anybody who accuses me of such looks really crazy and paranoid to me.
Yeah. Well, everyone's, this is the thing as well. Everyone's coming to the table with their own beliefs. But can we put the mirror on our own beliefs and say, okay, I'm going to pick holes in my own belief. I'm going to take apart my own belief and look at the evidence for and against my belief without my emotions. That's a really hard thing to do, even for me, for the people who put a great deal of thought into this specific area of investigation. It's really hard to do, almost impossible. But if we can just start to move towards that less emotional interpretation of the truth, of what we deem the truth, what others deem the truth, we can find understanding with those who have opposite beliefs than ourselves. And I think that's the most important thing, and or the second most important thing. The most important thing, in my opinion, is we will stop being manipulated by faith peddlers, political or religious faith peddlers. Basically, in my opinion, our beliefs are like the little hooks that leaders can just stick their hooks into, basically, or little catches that our leaders can stick their hooks into and lead us wherever they want us to go. It's just provide the right emotional stimuli, the right scenario, and we will respond because they know our beliefs. They know that they're emotional. They know what upsets us, certain believers, what upsets other believers, and they can just give us the right stimuli to make us move like robots, basically. And so we're very easily manipulated by our emotions. And
well, that's very interesting because I was having a conversation, I think either yesterday or today, about how some radio show hosts appeal to emotions and things of that nature, and they become incredibly popular. You have a look at other talk radio show hosts who take emotion out of the game whatsoever, and just look at the information, and they barely anybody's ever heard of them or follows them. Yeah. You know. Because only those with critical thinking ability actually like those kind of shows. And the rest of the people are just easily drug around by their emotions, especially in a movement like conspiracy theories and things of that nature.
Yeah. I spent some time researching conspiracy theories for a while. Some, I think, have quite a bit of evidence behind them. Some, in my opinion, don't. But again, I'm bringing my own personal biases and beliefs to the table, so I recognize that. Actually, I don't know if you've heard of a guy called David Icke.
I've interviewed him, yep.
Oh, you've interviewed him, yeah. He published one of my articles. It's actually an excerpt from Volume 3, I Am Christ, The Ascension Understanding, which is on the church's use of hypnotic manipulation. And so I go through and I show how the church uses the five steps of hypnotherapy in each church service, whether it's Protestant, Evangelical, Catholic. And so I go through that, yeah.
Wow. Well, I think that's another interesting element that we should cover after the break. Churches using five stages of hypnotherapy. That sounds intensely interesting to me. We'll be right back with my very special guest, Michael Sherlock. Just a few Thank minutes, you. Ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's the final segment that we've got here on air with Michael Sherlock. I think he's the author of the book I Am Christ, and Suzanne Posel just kind of sitting there in the background, you know, snuggling into a beanbag or something. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Vincent.
All right. Where were we? The five methods of hypnosis or mind control or something in a church service? What were they?
Okay, yeah. So in the third volume of the series, which won't be out till next year sometime, it's a little, it's in the future, it's coming in the future. I go into the five stages of hypnotherapy and I show how those stages exist within the church service. And that is the introduction, the induction, the deepening, the suggestion, and the awakening. Those five stages can be found in a church service, in any church service, and I thoroughly demonstrate that over a whole very big chapter in my book. But I wrote a small excerpt. I took a little bit of that out and made it its own article. So I made an article out of that. And David Icke published it, and Red Ice Radio, can't remember the guy from Red Ice Radio.
Heinrich.
Yeah, I really like that guy. These kind of guys published it. So they found something of value in it. But I wasn't really coming from a conspiratorial point of view when I wrote that. But I think that it certainly can be used in that, because politicians use, you know, hypnosis, trance, induction, these kind of things. They use NLP, which is neuro-linguistic programming, and I have a whole chapter dedicated to neuro-linguistic programming in the Christian church as well, in the third volume of my series, because the third volume, basically my three-volume series, is an analogy, a metaphoric three-step process to enlightenment. But it's not a how-to manifesto of enlightenment. You're not going to learn how to become a free thinker. Someone once said that critical thinking is never inherited. And it's up to you. I can't give you something. I can't give you a magic pill or a couple of magic words that's going to change you into a critical thinker. You have to find that within yourself. And so basically, my three-volume series, The Crucifixion, is volume one, and that's about succumbing to your own mental crucifixion, giving up your beliefs, recognizing your beliefs for what they are. They're emotionally driven, emotionally maintained. A belief is a matter of fact. A belief is a matter of choice, not a matter of fact. Yeah, so that's very important, I think. Belief is a matter of choice, not a matter of fact. Too many people overlook that. And so it's about succumbing to your psychological crucifixion. It's very Jungian in a sense. And Joseph Campbell, I don't know if you've heard of Joseph Campbell, the great mythology lecturer from Princeton. He's from another college, so I can't remember, but he was very good, and he followed a lot of Jungian teachings and sought out a lot of symbolism, valuable psychological symbolism that are in our ancient myths. And I do that as well in my book, in the second chapter, with the psychological phoenix. I use the phoenix as an analogy of this crucifixion of the mind. And coincidentally, Clement of Rome, an early church father, saw the story of the phoenix is very similar to Christ, and that is the death and resurrection motif coming out. And it's about that. It's about the death, giving up the ego, letting the ego die, and having it resurrected. Now, the pernicious side of most religions, in my opinion, is that they will exoterically, on the surface, promote humility. They will promote giving up the ego. And I think those are very good things. But to follow these religions, you must become egocentric. You must submit to the doctrines of this religion. You must see your religion as the only right religion. My beliefs are the right beliefs. My God is the only true God. And this is the textbook definition of egocentrism. So you have to become egocentric in order to follow these religions that are saying you should be humble and you shouldn't be an egocentric. And so that's a great irony of religion. It's a great kind of doublespeak of religion, if you like. And once you're egocentric, you're basically easy to control. Egocentrics are very easy to control. So the first volume is to do with the crucifixion mind. The second volume is the resurrection. I am Christ, the resurrection. That volume deals specifically with the history of the Christian church. The manipulation of history. We've all been led to believe that Christians were persecuted everywhere prior to the 4th century, and it was all the time. There was nothing but Christian persecution, and the persecution is used as a tool to convert new people out of sympathy. And we can say, we can see that Islam is doing the same in the West today. Many Muslims have been unjustly persecuted after 9/11. And this sympathy that, that a lot of people have has turned Islam into a counterculture. Okay, it's turning Islam into a counterculture in Europe. And you'll see that the numbers of Muslim converts are going, starting to skyrocket. And that is because people see it as a counterculture to an oppressive regime, an oppressive government, which these governments are oppressive. But they're falling into a counterculture that is equally as oppressive. And that is, if you look, if you read through the Quran, you read through the Muslim Hadith, you see they're extremely oppressive, they're manipulative. It's the same as Christianity. It's Christianity Mark II, basically. And so the resurrection deals with the manipulated history, going through all that. It looks at the fictional nature of the Christ figure. That is, and I use comparative mythology to show that this character existed 1,000 years at least prior to Jesus Christ of the Gospels. That is, someone who was born of a virgin, who escaped early infanticide by a local tyrant, who was, now there's just so many in there, who died and was resurrected, and all these motifs who ascended in front of people. And you can, if you look at all the ancient literature, you'll see that all these motifs for Christ existed in the earlier religion. And this is what led St. Augustine, the early church father, to say that what we call Christianity existed amongst the ancients, which is a very odd statement to make. It's supposed to be a historical religion based on a savior who came 2,000 years ago, was unique, but the fact is, no, it wasn't. It's been around for a very long time. And so,
I heard that as well, that Christianity itself as a religion is as old as the human race itself.
Well, that's somewhat of a yes and no. The motifs that exist within the Gospels that were selected by the proto-Orthodox Church existed. And another qualification is that the proto-Orthodox Church, which later became the Catholic Church, which later became the Protestant Church, and all the 38,000 other denominations now Christianity, that one small handful of men selected 4 Gospels through Irenaeus. They selected his choice of Gospels. He lived in about 180 BCE. He's the one who first said, we need 4 Gospels, no more, because there were hundreds of Gospels, or at least 100 Gospels, you know, all by... are possessed by different sects who all believe they had the Orthodox word of God. They were Gnostics. Yeah, so.
Can I ask you, what's the definition of a gospel? Like, if I was to write down, you know, the gospel according to Vinnie Eastwood or something, would that wash?
I think it would, in my opinion. A gospel is just it comes from the Greek term evangelion, meaning the good word or the good news. And basically, in my cynical opinion, it is what I call a God spell. That is, it's not, I don't believe it's from God, I don't believe it's the word of God, I don't even believe in God. I have no reason to believe in God. If God exists, she exists. I don't have evidence either way, so I'm not going to attempt to jump to a conclusion and form a belief about that. So I went off track. What was I saying?
I was just wondering, if I was to write a book called the Gospel According to Vinnie Eastwood, would that actually technically be a gospel? You know, what actually defines a gospel? What actually is it?
Like what makes a gospel canonical, like actually accepted as a legitimate Christian gospel?
Or any gospel. I mean, how many gospels are there? What are the parameters?
Acharya, I don't know if you've heard of Acharya S. She's written a few books like The Christ Conspiracy, Christ in Egypt, and some very good books.
No, I've only heard of Acharya at a barbecue.
Okay. All right, well, look her stuff up. She's quite good. She brought out a book called The Gospel According to Acharya, and it's basically just some of her opinions on some of the different religious things and stuff like that. And so that was quite good. But, yeah, I mean, you make a gospel according to Vincent, I'll read it.
Yeah. We did do a song called The Gospel According to Raptor Jesus. You ever seen the picture of Raptor Jesus?
I haven't seen a picture of Raptor Jesus, no.
Well, it's just a picture of Jesus with a raptor head, you know, like from Jurassic Park, and it says Raptor Jesus. He went extinct for your sins. And I just thought it was okay. So funny, you know, and just, you know, with the clasped hands and everything looks so serene with a giant raptor head and stuff. It's just classic.
Actually, if you want some funny images, yeah, go to Facebook. Look at some of the atheist pages on Facebook. Even go to mine, because I make a lot of picture quotes and stuff like that that you can pick up. And I love some of the stuff that's floating around there. Most of my page on Facebook is original quotes that I make. And I'm collating them, and I think I might publish them in like a gospel according to Sherlock. And that's a good name for a gospel, Sherlock. So,
yeah.
You gave me an idea. You gave me a good idea.
There you go. The gospel according to Sherlock. Right. Well, we're going to be continuing this conversation off the air, ladies and gentlemen. So if you would like to be part of this conversation, if you have me on Skype, the Skype name is Vincent.Eastwood. If you want to listen in while we talk after the break with Suzanne Posel and Michael Sherlock, you can add me on there and we'll be continuing that in just a few moments. So, Michael, thank you very much for joining us on air. Suzanne Posel, the caller that we had, I think it was Ernest or something, and also our first hour guest named Ogmios, is a very talented musician. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen.